Well, it seems everyone survived the Olympics. And now we can all look forward with joy and happiness to this convention. In the meantime, we will work with the subject of the morning. We all have problems of disposition. And we love disposition very deeply. I remember that friend came to me with many difficulties and admitted that they were extremely selfish and that might have something to do with it. But then they spoke right up and said, if it does, I have no intentions of changing. All I want to do is get rid of the consequences. This is human nature. And it is something we all have to face in ourselves and in others. We have to do the best we can to face the inconsistencies that lurk somewhere in the subconscious parts of ourselves. The purpose of philosophy primarily is to help individuals to overcome their own peculiarities. It is that the individual, if he knows enough and is sincere enough, will make the changes necessary to improve his own disposition. If he is not that sincere or does not have that ability, then nature steps in and presents him with a series of complex situations in which the attitudes that he holds that are not right will begin to plague him. He will suffer from consequences, but he will try to avoid the correction of causes. Now, dispositions are variously influenced by circumstances. Most of the influences that affect disposition come from the outside. On the daily pattern of living, we are all upset and worried and frightened, and we are all trying desperately to succeed, even if it is at the expense of principles or each other. This accounts for most of the compromises that we make. We gradually come to the conclusion that the integrities that we really believe in cannot be applied to the common problems of daily living. We know what we should do, but for one reason or another, we do not feel that we are capable of doing what we should do because it interferes with doing what we want to do. Thus it is that in this world, everyone is more or less a servant or an employee. He is employed by others or he is employed by himself. He can be self-employed and still work for someone else. The self-employed individual is working constantly to achieve his own purposes and is loyal to his chief employer, which is himself. Others are loyal to the office or organization to which they belong, and they give the best service they can. And this loyalty is usually recognized. Actually, there are many ways of looking at a problem. One of the ways to look at it is that if you change the outside, there is no proof that it's going to change the inside. The individual who changes his standard of living, moving upward into a more luxurious environment, does not inevitably become a better person. In fact, he becomes more inclined to be a less sufficient person. The more he has, the more the temptations build. And no amount of external success assures the person of a good life. If, on the other hand, the individual starts from the inside, he can gradually learn that the inside will change the outside into what it should be, if it's given a chance. That the best part of the individual's conduct is motivated from within himself. It may be for love of God, or love of country, or love of family, the love of principles, service, the love of the sick. All these are unselfish dedications which, coming from the inside, enrich the personal life and also provide a motive or reason actually for existence. There is really no legitimate reason why we are here if we cannot think of anything except ourselves. So disposition is something that you can work with in children, but if you wait too long, you're almost always going to get into a complicated situation. You cannot spoil a child for the first 15 years of life and then have a well-adjusted child later. You cannot be unpleasant in your relationships with friends, family, and business associates indefinitely and retain their friendship and cooperation. So it is very necessary for us to have a proper background upon which to build a life that is valuable and useful. Of course, in these days, we are much inclined to overlook the religious equation. We are more or less of the belief that you cannot apply religion to trade and industry, that the person cannot live according to the laws of God in a world dominated by the laws of men. To a measure, there may be some excuse for this attitude, but it is more or less of an excuse, basically. Because even in industry and business, integrities are important. And integrities are very important to the person himself and the development of his way of life. So I think we can say that basically, a good business career, a good achievement in science, or in art, or music, investment, banking, law, that all of these specialized fields require a religious factor to maintain their integrities. Remove religion as principles of integrity from any system of thought, and that system will deteriorate and die. Consequently, in human relationships, dispositions must finally come under the dominion of the golden rule. Dispositions must be constantly guided in ways of peace, of happiness, of sincerity. Dispositions must be taught to forgive, must be taught to rise above small personal grievances. All these things are partly possible through a constructive religious relationship with life. The individual who follows the Sermon on the Mount, or one of the dialogues of Buddha, and lives according to these rules, will be a good person. And this good person is not only more secure in this world, but faces the unknown future with a better hope. We must gradually weed out that part of our own nature which is destructive. We must get rid of the battlefield in ourselves if we expect to cure war in the world. It is impossible for the individual to break rules without this breakage spreading through society and making life impossible for other people. So in disposition, we start perhaps in an oriental mood. One of the beginnings of disposition may be to learn how to keep quiet. Because in quietude, we give disposition an opportunity to relax. We also give a greater opportunity in meditation and thoughtfulness for character to assert itself over the passing moods of the moment. We cannot make valuable decisions that are really going to work unless we make them when we are in a state of peace. This is very, very necessary to us. Pythagoras warned parents that no parent should ever rebuke a child while the parent themselves is angry. It must be done from a standpoint of principles, and the parent must set the example of right attitude in efforts to correct or condition the attitudes of children. So here we come into a very simple problem that people have lost the knack of being quiet. They have lost that Zen relaxation which always associates itself with a firm and balanced judgment. You cannot sit on one end of the scales and expect an honest judgment. You must relax from within yourself, and this must be done under a discipline. Every person, even a child in their early teens, should at least once a day have a period of 15 minutes of quietude. A quietude that is not interrupted by television. A quietude that is not interrupted by all kinds of social activities. A simple quietude of being in a state of relaxation. A state in which the person is ready and able to receive the subtle impressions that come from his own soul. If he is not still, the soul cannot speak to him. And if the soul cannot speak to him, he cannot know the spirit. Therefore, to begin with, this position is not something you fight. It is something you outgrow by the simple process of gaining control over attitudes that disturb your mental and emotional equilibrium. So in all problems, the old Christian family had prayer. They said grace at meal and were thankful for the food. They gave very special attention to the children. They read from the Bible. They went to church at least once a week. They lived in an atmosphere dominated by the words of Jesus. Now, this has passed. Now, there's no doubt in the world that in those days there was a great deal of smug hypocrisy. There were people who did not understand or did not really want to grow. Many went to church only to be seen there. But at the same time, there was a general accepted standard of life. People were supposed to be divided into two general groups. The lower one of which cared for nothing in particular. On the upper part, or upper half, was constantly aware of the responsibility of maturity and tried to do something about it. So here today, we have a world full of war, with more and more alarm everywhere. And the individual gets into a kind of panic. He gets his nervous system all disturbed. He gets a little short in his attitudes towards other people. He nurses more grudges. He condemns more politicians and miscellaneous people. He finds something wrong with just about everything. Now, he may be right, but this endless finding of wrong is going to damage him. He must try to understand why things are wrong. He must learn to understand why we do not have any peace in the world. He has to learn why the United Nations can't function. He must learn why the local situation is requiring that everyone put iron bars on his windows and doors. These things are situations, and we have to try to understand how they come about and why, and to a measure why each of us in some degree is responsible for the condition. Because very few people are standing firmly on principles. And these are the only answers that can ever produce the ends that we desire. So we will hope that from the years of association we have had here, that the individual has gradually found a strengthening of character, that inside the resources of self-improvement are greater than they were before, that each person knows a little more about the laws of nature, knows to experience a little bit more about the will of God, and most of all has learned by possibly bitter experience what happens to individuals, groups, or nations that fall for arrogance and selfishness. All of these considerations help the person to be self-controlling and self-directing. So when you sit down for the little quiet time, the problem always is to observe that this quietness depends for its expression and its completion upon a certain basic constitutional attitude. The person who is basically kind will find a philosophy of kindness evolving within himself, which will protect him from many evils. He will find also that this kindness spreads through society, and that others, inspired by his attitudes, will try to do a little better themselves. So all the way along through the problems of life, we have to keep a definite contact with the interior soul factor in ourselves. We have to be sure in our natures that the best in us is guiding the rest of us, that the leadership is in the hands of the most able part of our own being. As we approach a political situation, we are not all convinced that the candidates are what they ought to be, or that the election is going to produce any very great difference in our general condition. We are not aware or not certain that leadership, as we know it, is sufficient, is dependable, and is dominated by unselfish idealism. Now go to ourselves for a moment. What part of ourselves have we elected to office as the guardian and guide of our lives? From what level of our own internal mechanism are we fashioning a philosophy which is to protect us, guide us, and inspire us through the years of our material existence? Are we allowing the best part of ourselves to govern the rest? Or are we constantly hiding the best because it interferes with the things we want to do? The labors of self-centeredness, selfishness, ambition, and revenge are not part of a message that comes from the best part of ourselves. It comes from a level that is not fit to govern. It is a level that, if it does get into the seat of government, will be arrogant, destructive, hateful, and abusive. Therefore, if we must make a life decision, what is the highest concept of life that we can imagine? What is our idea of a truly mature person as we try to contemplate upon such a person in the act of meditation? When we are trying to decide which part of our own natures is the best to lead the rest, we will come to some rather interesting decisions, experiences. We have to learn as people learn that if we want good government, the governed must be reliable and intelligent. If we want the government of our personal lives to be responsible, we must therefore make it possible for that level of government to be in office and stay there. This means that the person has to defend the best part of himself if he wishes to benefit by its contributions. the possibility of achieving internal security without keeping a pact of relationship with the divine part of ourselves is impossible. Now, what is this divine part of ourselves going to do? It is going to do very largely that which the embodiment and personification of that divine self in the power and principle of Jesus Christ is to be the leader of our lives. If we belong to another religion, that's fine, because every worthwhile religion has had exactly the same attitude on this subject, namely that if we want to achieve security and peace, we must keep the rules of life. Now, one of the things we learn, and which we are taught from childhood in Bible schools and other places, is forgiveness. That we must learn to forgive instead of revenge. That we must learn to be kind instead of critical. That we cannot afford to have so many friends that we can afford one enemy, especially if we have caused that enemy ourselves. So everywhere in relationships, we realize the words, "Blessed are the peacemakers." That every one of us, in every walk of life, should try in every way that we can to keep the peace. And in so doing, inspire others to do the same. In the raising of children particularly, the keeping of the peace, the maintenance of a family relationship that is kindly, generous, sympathetic, this is the main success of a home. And without it, we don't have a home. Yet today, thousands, millions of homes are involved in constant conflicts over matters that should never have entered into the situation at all. So in meditation, we try to straighten out something. We try to substitute an inner control for this outward flare-up that is a serious detriment to everyone concerned. Now, another problem is of trying to understand these matters has to do with the transformation of grievances. A grievance is something that an individual will nurse for the rest of their lives. It is easy, apparently, to forget anything good that ever happened to us, but never forget anything that was unfortunate. So we therefore have the problem of trying to understand why things happen. If we have no philosophy of life, or are stock materialists, or devotees of the Darwinian theory, we have no problem, because life has no purpose. And each individual is supposed to get along as comfortably as possible until he fades away. But if by some chance we really believe that we are thoughtful, there is nothing to prevent thoughts from being tested. In the ancient mystery systems of Greece and Egypt and India, no one was permitted into the temples for initiatory rites until they had been thoroughly tested. And this is still true in esoteric Buddhism in Japan, China, and Korea, Tibet. The individual must prove an achievement of internal integrity. He cannot simply go in as an individual full of faults and wait for the religion to save him. He is not actually acceptable into any school of mysticism until he has already corrected the more obvious and tantalizing faults that he may suffer from. So in Egypt they were tested, and in Greece. And let us not think for a moment that these tests were superficial. These tests did not consist of a ritual in which the individual simply watched somebody else go through a ceremony. These tests were long, complicated, dangerous, and in many cases failure was almost inevitable. There was just that little spark of possibility that the individual would superimpose upon his common nature a higher nature long enough to pass the test. On many occasions, in Egypt particularly, those who took the initiations and did not pass them did not again appear in the world. They were not injured, but they became part of a great system that took care of the mortuary rites of the dead. There was nothing funny, foolish, or superficial about these rites. They were real. One Roman emperor who was good enough, apparently, to be given the opportunity was attacked by masked priests. Their purpose was to reveal to him the uselessness of violence. But he did not pass the test, and in his failure killed one of the priests by accident. Therefore, these were not just wordy rituals. You didn't pay $5 initiation fee or something, and all went well. You had to earn it. Now, those rites have more or less disappeared from our world. But instead of rites, we have riots. Instead of the rites in the temple, we have the riots in the marketplace. The whole world has suddenly become a sanctuary for the testing of human character. We are all faced with the same tests that were found in the caverns under Sais and Memphis. We are still being tested as to the integrities of our inner lives. And unless we pass the test, we have to continue to take the examinations until we do. But once we have transcended a weakness of character, once we have departed from our natural human emotions to contemplate the mystery of divine nature, we can do these things with considerable ease. It is not an impossible task. Let us therefore think of this world not just as a schoolroom, as Paracelsus termed it, but as a mystery temple, a place where individuals are tested. Now, one of the reasons why the old system faded away was because it became ever increasingly necessary for those leaders who invisibly guided humanity through its immediate infancy to realize that sometime the child had to grow up, that it could not be protected forever by the presence of divine powers, that it could not depend upon angels and archangels and the seraphim to guide it through the mysteries of life. The child was growing up. It had to stand on its own feet. It had to make its own integrities. It had to prove its own strength. It had to go out and win a victory over the weaknesses which might still lurk within its composition. So the initiations today are in daily life. The family squabble, the business squabble, the professional jealousies, the corruption of office, all these things are problems that the individual has to correct. And everyone in all walks of life who is breaking the law must take the consequences. Now, most people are beginning to be rather aware of these consequences. We are beginning to recognize that we are not living the way we should. And we are also beginning to realize that, at least in part, it's our own fault and not the fault of some mysterious over-political structure that is going to take care of us. We are each of us dependent upon our own integrities. So if we view this life we live as a test of character, we know when we win it, and we know when we lose it, and we also know when we try to avoid it. We find that avoidance is nothing. It helps no way. Whatever it was we tried to avoid is still sitting on our doorstep later. We must achieve certain things. And it must be the victory of character over disposition. It is not possible for the individual to continually function in a weather of changing attitudes. He has got to begin to strengthen his purposes, strengthen his life, and make himself a useful instrument in a plan. Now, if this was, as some people still believe, if this was the only chance we have to live, if this is the only life we will ever have, and is the only one we ever have had, it might be a little different. But we have to recognize the fact that what we accomplish now, if it is right, contributes to permanent growth. If it is wrong, remains an obstacle to growth until the wrong is righted. So it is very important, as it was in the ancient days, for the individual to enter the temple with the full realization of integrity. In the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece, the initiation of a candidate was the final statement that that person was right. The temple turned down the rich and the powerful. When one man was falsely accused of a crime which was to be held against him, he asked to be submitted to the test of the mysteries. He asked that the priests who sat in judgment should try his case and decide whether he was worthy to be initiated into the Eleusinian rites. If he was found worthy by the committee that examined him, this was sufficient to assure that no one else outside of the temple would ever have the right to condemn him or criticize him or doubt him for that incident. If, however, as in the case of Constantine, the emperor, he was not sure of his own integrities, he went to Eleusis to be initiated, hesitated, and went away without entering the temple because he knew in his heart the crimes he had committed. Therefore, in the temple mysteries, the final test of preparedness was a kind of examination in which the life of the person was taken under the most careful scrutiny, sometimes requiring weeks or months of research to decide. But if accepted, it meant that the common faults from which the average person suffers had been already corrected. Then the final correction took place in the rite itself, where the initiate-to-be was faced with the realization that in any emergency of life in which character was involved, he must be willing to die rather than to commit an ignoble deed. Death before dishonor was written in very large letters in the mystery system. No individual was allowed to avoid or evade the fact that his principles had to be strong enough to carry him in peace, integrity, friendliness, affection, and regard through the most terrible emergencies of life. Well, people say that was all long ago and you can't do those things today. Well, it probably can't. But you can get into the same problems and you can have the same miserable time trying to get out of them. You find that we have to face, in this modern civilization, the future according to the light of the ancient wisdom. If we don't, we're going to be very unhappy and our homes will fail and our children will be no comfort to us. So we must work all the time we can. Now, how do we do some of this? Well, we have a problem that most people have trouble with, and that's memory. It's very hard to forget grievances. They keep coming back and annoying us. And there is no way in which a grievance can be forgotten unless senility sets in or the individual goes under psychotherapy and it has it hypnotized out of his conscious memory. Even then, however, it's liable to slip back. But what is he going to do with a problem that he has hated, that he has mourned over, that he has fretted about, and that he has been disillusioned about. One person came to me and said they had not spoken to their own sister for 20 years on a grudge. And I asked her what the grudge was about. Well, she said, if the truth is known, I think you've all forgotten. Nothing remains but the grudge. I know I've got to hate her. Well, this type of thing is not uncommon, and sometimes it goes to church and doesn't pay any attention to that. It feels that it is perfectly right in its attitude. But it's very difficult, in fact impossible, to simply say, I didn't like this person, now I have to like them. Because my conscience tells me I should like them. Well, there is another end to this, which nature provides. And this is what is commonly called in the world philosophy. And philosophy is the reconciler of opposites. It is that power that makes the unreasonable suddenly become factual. It is also that by means of which we can transform any incident of our lives from a tragedy to a lesson. It is actually sometimes possible, I've actually heard people express it, that an injury that was done to them was the best thing that ever happened to them, because it made them think, made them try to find a solution, made them believe that they had to make certain changes in themselves. A man was a heavy drinker, and he carried it like a gentleman for a long time. Then one day, he had a serious fight and brutally beat up his own wife. This suddenly he woke up. For this incident, which was a terrible incident, and one that was very hard for the wife to survive, was the end of the grievance at nature in himself. He stopped drinking, he realized what had happened, and sent his life to self-improvement, which ended ultimately in a better condition for all concerned. So things that happens that are wrong, if we accept that wrongness and realize it and take it as a test rather than as an unfair situation, whether it's fair or unfair, it has to be solved by consciousness on a higher level than the consciousness on which the grudge exists. We can't settle it or destroy the grudge on its own level. We have to rise above it. We have to see that there is a lesson behind every disaster. There is a great principle involved in every catastrophe. It's hard to realize this, and sometimes our human judgments do fail. We can't quite handle it. But at the same time, it does help in a great many moderate cases of hatreds to realize that they can be changed, and that out of a situation that has been an annoyance, there can arise a great advancement of our own inner development, that we become wiser, greater, better, and more kindly as the result of a tragic situation of some kind. While Pythagoras was teaching at Crotona, he had among his disciples one young man who was what we would call today slow of learning. He never seemed to catch on to anything correctly. He misunderstood, and he tried desperately hard, but he couldn't understand or take on the heavy elements of a philosophical discipline. And finally one day Pythagoras became so annoyed at him that he made a sharp rebuke of his stupidity. The boy reached into his girdle, took out a dagger, and killed himself in the presence of Pythagoras. Pythagoras took the oath on the body of the boy that never again while he lived would he criticize any living thing. Now these are lessons which are part of the old mystery system, things that we have to learn the hard way. But the learning of them is a great benefit. And as we become less and less addicted to defense of unworthy causes, we have more energy, we have more vitality, we are able to accomplish more. There is nothing that drops us into neurasthenia more easily than a constantly negative attitude on something. Criticism ends in a definite psychosis, and it becomes chronic, and it will gradually result in early senility of the involved person. It is a waste of energy. The only use of energy that is not a waste is kindness. Otherwise, it is a loss for all concerned. Out of kindness comes all the good that we can do for ourselves and each other. So the problem of getting around this business of dispositions is to recognize the disposition not as a disaster, but as a challenge. And also, for once and for all, get over the idea that our disposition has been adversely affected by other people. Other people can do what they can to make us uncomfortable sometimes, but they cannot reach us if we are solidly established in principles within ourselves. We can take whatever they say and take it in kindness. Or we can take the losses that they bring or the cruelties which they circulate with the realization that the only answer is, as Edwin Markham pointed out, the only answer to the cruelty of another is simple love. The other person may reject it, but that is the only emotion we can afford for ourselves. Otherwise, we get into the same problem, and there's nothing more miserable than the circumstance of people all to blame worrying about their problems. Now, if in the devotional theories of antiquity and of the Orient today, the religious life, the life of discipline, has to have certain symbols. If we want to live better, think better, and be better, it becomes necessary for us to begin doing better things. We have to give expression to the part of us that we really want to use. The individual with all the resolution in the world to be kindly doesn't have the full fulfillment of this resolution until he is kind to something or for someone. Therefore, the individual must begin to manifest in daily life the symptoms of the things that he should be doing. Now, a great deal of unhappiness, misery, and conflict comes from people who are actually not using faculties and allowing them to more or less decay. The individual who does not have a well-planned program of constructive activity is apt to fall back into destructive attitudes. We have to have a daily outlet, a constant outlet for something that satisfies the inner life. Now, we have a number of possible selections. One of the most interesting and improving, probably, is art. Art is a magnificent way of expressing beauty. And all that is noble in man's nature is beauty. And the beauty is one of the three primary aspects of deity. Everything that deity creates is beautiful in itself. The universe is beautiful. The flower is beautiful.